Chapter 15, A Gift from Commendus. Highgate was filled with beauty and elegance. The smallest homes and apartments were built with such wonderful craftsmanship that it was clear everyone in town had plenty to eat and could safely be considered a city slicker. The roads were all paved flat or cobblestone, and the gardens were beautiful and orderly. The metropolis was picture-perfect. Even the garbage collectors out working the streets appeared well-groomed and happy. At the top of the first knoll, which appeared to be the highest point of the city, Boot forced the others to stop by a charming monument so Dodd could take in the stunning view. Highgate was huge. It spanned tens of miles, covering hills and valleys in a circular bowl shape, with thousands of towering buildings and structures poking above the tree-filled landscape. It was mind-bogglingly large, considering it was entirely protected by an impenetrable tri-block field. "Wow, this is Highgate," sighed Dodd, astonished. It was much bigger than Salt Lake or Las Vegas. "You've been here before, haven't you?" asked Dilly. Dodd didn't say yes, but he nodded. It wasn't exactly a lie. He couldn't personally recall having visited the city, yet he did have memories of Highgate. He recognized the view he was looking at, almost like it had already been shown to him in a photograph, and he knew where certain shops were, and he remembered who lived in some of the houses. Many of the roads were so familiar to him that he could foretell what was behind each bend. Buck poked Dilly for asking such a ridiculous question. "Of course he's been here before," he chided. "Dodd worked for Commendus, remember? He helped try to sell Odungo and Bowler to rescue the stolen triblot from Dredarius. This spot just makes you feel awestruck, doesn't it? And to think Bombu's parents gave this place up. It could have been yours, Dilly." Dodd glanced down at the statue in front of him, which was surrounded by pigeons. It was a bronze of two people holding hands, looking out over the valleys. And below them, the words Tilius, Freedom for All. "I'm perfectly satisfied with visiting, thank you," answered Dilly with a grin. She was obviously pleased at the thought of being an ex-heiress to the magnificent city. In truth, it wouldn't be so magical if we still ruled over Highgate. Democracy breathed life into it that the finest of monarchs couldn't have achieved. And educated, wealthy, wonderful people came from everywhere to be part of what we see today. It's the best in all of us, the grand dream, the lingering hope of what my family trusts can one day become everyone's inheritance. Dilly's eyes filled with tears as she said, "May this spread. Long live democracy." It was a patriotic moment. Dodd thought of Pap standing proudly saluting the American flag as the anthem was sung before a Bees game in Salt Lake City. He had never spent time considering what exactly Pap had so solemnly saluted until that moment. Pap had paid respect to the flag because of what Dilly had just described, the beauty and power and glory of democracy, a cause worth fighting for and, if need be, worth dying for. Buck's horse pranced between Shooter and Song long enough to change the conversation. "Shouldn't we hurry to the palace?" said Buck, looking at Dodd. "I bet Commendus has lunch ready for us, which would be nice since somebody smashed the provisions Mercy gave us." "It's not my fault," argued Dodd helplessly, peering at Buck from behind Boot. Everyone had missed breakfast due to Dodd's regrettable horse experience, so the mention of food was a sore topic. Fortunately, it didn't take long before Dodd recognized they were getting close. They had only ridden for about 15 minutes when they came to a crowded complex of gigantic buildings. A wide courtyard, sprawling like the Mall in Washington, D.C., was paved with red stones and was lined on each side with 20 glorious buildings. They were identical and made of the most beautiful white marble and adorned with magnificent carvings and golden trim. In front of the entrances, decorated poles rose 50 feet out of the ground, giving the buildings a way to tell them apart. The fancy posts were like flags to the people in green and were decorated intricately. A white one with red dots, a blue one with yellow and black streaks, a red one with white squares and green triangles, a purple and green swirled one with yellow capping at the top, and so forth, 40 in all. Thousands of people, a vast majority of whom were treaders, moved about the strip with purpose, either as tourists or professionals. Most of them were on foot, though a few carefully made their way, as Dodd and his friends did, on horseback. However, there were no wagons or other conveyances allowed in the courtyard. As Dodd thought about it, wondering how such a vast number of people came and went, he found that recollections flooded his mind, answering his questions. Behind the buildings, back roads webbed efficiently, allowing all sorts of chartered transit to flow in an orderly fashion. And also, more amazingly, an underground waterway transported people in mini submarines, whizzing them up and down the hills of Highgate inside a pipe-like stone system, It was pollution-free and ran on pressurized water that ingeniously utilized a series of lakes. The network was made possible because of a mighty underground river that poured into Highgate from the towering Hook Mountains to the north and east. In the end, a majority of the water eventually made its way past the southernmost point of the city and into a small body of water called Lake Charms. There, a port harbored ships from all over the world of green. With the proper paperwork, vessels were allowed to come north up the Blue River, a 600-mile journey from Port Glantra on the Carsalian Sea. It was baffling to think that most of the people visiting Highgate crossed oceans to eventually disembark at the doorstep of the grand capital that was cradled in the foothills of the mountains. Only a few locals came by horse. Dodd looked around gawkingly. There were millions of inhabitants in Highgate, and yet the feeling was warm and inviting. He was so mesmerized by what he saw that it took Dilly 3 attempts before Dodd realized she was talking to him. "Now, Dodd, where are you from?" she asked, glancing at the pulse respectfully.
I'm from all over the world," said Dodd.
He didn't know how to respond. Dilly clearly wanted to know which post he hailed to, for the beautiful displays were actually representing the 40 areas in green, and the buildings they were in front of were filled with dignitaries and ambassadors who represented hundreds of millions of people. It was the political nexus for the whole world of green. Dodd stumbled on his answer, because an honest one would be none of the posts, or rather, the American flag. Fortunately, before Dilly noticed Dodd's distressful blush, Sonny began blurting a string of things about their beautiful pole that was completely pine green with one white circle at the top. It symbolically portrayed the world in harmony with nature and ruled wisely by truth and knowledge. The pole was right in the middle of the strip, and as they approached it, Sonny drew her arm to the square, honoring all it represented. Dodd felt dumb, recognizing he had walked past an identical one dozens of times at Twist Yard and had thought that it was sloppy to put such a bizarre thing in the open field. "I think Yorkham has got to be the greatest province in green," said Sonny patriotically, beginning on a lecture about the factual realities that made her homeland the best. From Terraboom in the north, with its world-class industry, to the fertile grain fields surrounding Crosswinds, to the ambience and culture of Carsego, to Port Glantra in the south with its unsurpassed prowess at global trade, we've easily got five times as many educated people in our cities as the best of the others. And just look, Highgate, our crowning jewel. It's the only place anywhere that you can see the splendor and wealth of buildings like this meet up with the functionality of an underground public transit, and it's all well protected by a tri-block field. Dodd wondered what she would say if she could see Chicago or New York, with their skyscrapers, airports, and subways, but he didn't say anything. "I wouldn't be talking, Missy," chided Buck, getting annoyed that Sonny was overly complimentary of her own province, which contained both her childhood home in Terraboom and her great-grandfather's estate at Twist Yard. "Have you ever seen Stahlbush?" he asked, challenging her. "She wouldn't need to," answered Dilly, getting ruffled into the dispute. "What's in Stahlbush? Nothing but an ocean of hills and sheep. It's barely got enough people to call it a province at all." "Hardly," said Boot, quickly defending his homeland. "It has twice as much dirt as Yorkham, and Ridgeland alone has nearly 500,000 people, and it's got as many scholars as Lower Janus per capita. Not to mention, since you're from Terraboom, only a couple hundred miles to the south, what's your excuse for never having scampered your way up to see it when you were young?" "I suppose," said Dilly smugly, "because you were living there. Besides, Ridgeland isn't the average city in Stahlbush. It's nearly the only one. I'm more than confident Terraboom alone has more people than your whole province, and the two above yours as well." "It's because so much of the ground is wasteland," added Sonny wryly. "You can't blame people for wanting to live here instead of there. Yorkham is beautiful." "Like you don't have your share of garbage," said Boot, chuckling. "How can you call that garbage?" asked Dilly, pointing northward at the Hook Mountains that towered above the buildings, gracing Highgate with a beautiful backdrop. "Think east," said Boot, raising an eyebrow. He looked at Dilly and waited for her to get it. When she didn't respond, he helped jog her memory by pointing at his foot. "Oh, yeah," said Dilly, looking embarrassed. "I guess some of our provinces, well, not as nice." Buck traded smiles with Boot. To the east of Highgate, the ankleweed desert covered hundreds of square miles. It was indisputably the most barren land in green. Its sand was poisonous to roughly all plants, rendering it void of vegetation, regardless of rainfall. "Here's to the two of you, then," said Sonny, looking self-satisfied as she pointed at the last post on their right as they passed by.
It was brown with black and white goats up the side. From your poll, I'd say Stallbush is trying hard to make sure everyone knows how educated and advanced your people are up north. Dilly smiled while Boot and Buck winced. Just around the corner from the busy hustle of the plaza, Commendus had his monstrous estate. It sat on a hillside looking out over the beautiful city, and its substantial acreage was all fenced with a stone wall and guarded by soldiers at the entrance. Once inside, Discomo Manor and the surrounding grounds were breathtaking. There were hundreds of well-manicured acres of grass and foliage, a lake, a castle, and a few other ornate buildings. The property was surprisingly open and pastoral, like a $100 million estate in the English countryside, and hardly fit the crowded neighborhood where the expensive real estate was thoughtfully organized with business and political buildings for miles in every direction. A wall of metropolis jutted upward along the outside perimeter of Commendus's grounds, like the stone city surrounding Central Park in the middle of New York, except the adjoining structures here weren't as big, and the commotion from the area was less raucous. Commendus was the beneficiary of his family's land, which had originally been passed down as an inherited stewardship. Later, when Bombu's parents possessed it, they gave Commendus's family full ownership. Though it was modest back then, it wasn't until Commendus took claim that the Grand Palace and surrounding luxuries were built, along with the burgeoning metropolis around it. Before him, Commendus's progenitors had been legendary farmers and cattlemen, giving him a perfect platform to launch his first successful business, a chain of stores selling meat and vegetable products with a uniform standard. The Discomo stores were an instant sensation, combining the family's reputation with Commendus's business savvy. After that, everything Commendus did seemed to flourish, including politics. At the entrance to the grounds, two dozen stones shaped like real cows dotted a flower garden. On each rock was engraven the full names of past stewards and owners of the land. Joshianok Diliano Discomo, Dasontrian Dilionus Discomo, Joshionelli Commendo Discomo, and 21 other names. The garden resembled a herd of cattle mischievously grazing on forbidden flowers and bushes. "Okay, Dilly," said Boot. "Tell me how that one is going to fit in the family garden." He smiled and pointed at an 80-foot granite rock carved in the shape of a hand that reached upward from the ground. It had Commendus Joshianelli Discomo carved across the palm. "It's not supposed to," answered Dilly plainly. "He's not a farmer. He's a civilized thinker." "I like it. He's probably symbolizing democracy rising out of the ground, and his proportions are perfect. We are only a twitching hand with most of us still buried in uncertainty." "Well, if that's to represent democracy, then it's funny he wrote his name across it," said Boot proudly. "He's the big hand that's helping democracy," responded Dilly. "Or he's the big hand that's ruling it out," contended Boot. Dilly didn't answer with words, yet the expression on her face said plenty. "Grow up." Beyond the immediate gardens at the front, grassy fields lined with gigantic trees surrounded a 50-acre pond. On the other side of the water, a massive bright white palace towered upward. Dot almost expected to see Cinderella running down the front steps with a handsome prince close on her heels. It was that kind of castle. Sonny took the lead, leaving her sister farther back, still crossing eyes with Boot. The group rode beside the lake, trotting along on a beautifully designed drive strip. Suddenly, three gardeners and a well-dressed man came bounding out of some shrubs, calling words of caution regarding something of interest. "Commendus," shouted Dilly. "I wouldn't have expected to see you out gardening." "You should expect the unexpected with me, my duckling," said Commendus in a loud voice. "I was just about to be shown our most fascinating visitor. The gardeners found her a few minutes ago and insisted I see for myself." "My duckling," whispered Dodd to Boot. "She swam a few times with the ducks in his pond," responded Boot in an equally quiet voice. "He gave her a fitting nickname, though you probably shouldn't try it. I know she's cold on the idea unless he's the one using it. Goes over even worse than Twisty." "I'm curious, who's your visitor?" asked Dilly. "Watch out," called one of the gardeners to Commendus. "You'd better move while you talk. Here she comes." Commendus jogged until he was next to the other gardeners and then turned to see his guest. What he saw was clearly a surprise to him, and it made him quiver. A 50-foot-long snake came slithering out of the bushes. It was silky black and covered in mud. The girth of the snake at its widest point was similar to Shooter's neck, and its eyes were a glazed white, as if it were dead. Commandus and the others dodged frantically to get out of the serpent's path as it made its way across the grass and road. Within a matter of a few seconds, the entire snake disappeared into the depths of the murky lake. "That's your guest?" gasped Dilly in horror. "And to think I used to enjoy a nice dip in that water. Never again." "That looked like a diserpentis," remarked Sonny in amazement. "I thought we didn't have any of those here in Green." "We didn't," said a man who was dressed as a gardener, yet he appeared older and more refined than the other two rougher-looking men. He stood up straighter, unlike the others who slouched, and his hair was well-combed and graying. He also had a notebook protruding from his pocket, instead of shovels and gloves. "Let me introduce Dr. Shelderhig Grick," interrupted a slightly cowering Commendus. "He has joined us here at the palace doing research, and I suppose he knows as much as anyone about that creature we just saw. Miz gave her to me years ago to keep in my exotic fountains on the back patio, but apparently when she disappeared, she wasn't eaten by a bird as Miz suggested. And to think he promised me she wouldn't grow an inch longer than 4 feet." "Living on guppies in your fountain, Miz would have been right," said Dr. Shelderhig. "Unfortunately, the fish and waterfowl in that pond will likely keep her nice and healthy, growing up to 100 feet if you don't poke her out. Of course, there's no need to take drastic measures too quickly. She won't be out of the water much, since she has gills like a fish, so if you refrain from swimming, you'll be all right for now." "But she was just up in the hedge, nearly had me for breakfast," sobbed the anxious gardener who had had the misfortune of originally discovering her. "If you don't get her, someone's going to be filling her gut, and it won't be me, I can assure you of that. I'm not going anywhere near that pond until she's gone." "Don't worry," Shelderhig reassured, as he disappeared into the thicket of shrubs. When he came back, he held up a clear sack of golf ball-sized eggs. They actually looked like little golf balls, without the dimples. "She was putting these in the ground," he said. "Their young start out breathing air, opposite of frogs, you know." "They're not fertile, are they?" asked Commendus, with a look of concern crossing his already flustered face. "Actually, yes they are," said Shelderhig factually. "They're like worms, can multiply pretty quickly, all alone, too." "I have a lake full of those," moaned Commendus, grabbing at his face torturously. "I'd kill Miz if he weren't already dead." "Don't get overly excited," said Shelderhig kindly. "I'm sure her past hatchlings slipped into your pond and Mama ate them for breakfast. There's not enough room for two in that pond when one is over 50 feet. "That's reassuring," said Commendus semi-sarcastically. He gazed irritably at the lake and shook his head in disapproval. "For what it's worth," added Shelderhig, "that's the best fed diserpentis I've ever seen. And I've seen quite a few of them over the course of my nearly 200 years in Sush. When you keep a pet, you really go all out." "Well," confessed an exasperated Commendus, "now I know why my guests haven't been lucky anymore at fishing for my famed 30-pound chublings. That thing has eaten them all." "Then dispose of her," said Shelderhig bluntly. Commendus shuddered. "I don't care for excitement of that kind. Adventure in the wild has never been my forte, much less retaking my yard from the coils of a physical contender. I think you, my dear doctor, are just the man to do something about my unusually healthy pet. Perhaps you could put your knowledge of diserpentises toward contriving a plan to exterminate it. I deeply appreciate your efforts. If you succeed, why, I'll buy you the whole list of things you indicated you hoped you'd eventually study. And I mean it. That red-blooming, pricey whatever you called it included. I give you my word." "Consider it done," responded Shelderhig. He drew himself into a soldier pose and strangely saluted Commendus with a tight fist over his forehead. Green's military style, even though Shelderhig was his senior. It was mostly a show of excitement from hearing his research agenda could be quickly funded if the feat were accomplished. "I admire your enthusiasm," said Buck, who had quietly listened to the conversation, wondering whether or not all the pampering in the world which was likely to be provided by Commendus was worth dwelling in a structure so close to the home of the beast he had just seen. "Oh, it shouldn't be that hard," stated Shelderhig confidently. "There's always something for getting something else." He made his way to the lakeside, taking big strides with every step, and began measuring the width of the muddy skid marks where the diserpentis had just entered the water. It was obvious he was a scientist. He instantly became more concerned with the facts surrounding the creature than he was of the danger it presented. Commendus took a ride, doubling with Dilly, to the thickly wooded side of the castle where the stables were located. He mostly spoke about the regrettable escape of the rare Dilcon diserpentis, originally given as a special gift from Miz, and how based on its current size, he no longer felt so special owning one. He also mentioned in passing that Dr. Schelderhig was Jim's uncle, and that despite being from the backwoods of Sush, a member of the Grit clan no less, he was rather well informed of the various plants and animals. Sonny, like the others, mostly listened while Commenda spoke, except mentioning she had read 8 books Dr. Schelderhig had authored. Dodd was hidden enough behind Boot's frame that he never entered the conversation, not even to be welcomed by the great head of democracy, notwithstanding he was the one that had been personally invited. Commandus was a man of interesting and somewhat dichotomous characteristics. He was much bigger and more muscular than most treaders, a solid 6'8", yet proclaimed having little interest in adventure or physical challenges, and was sweet and generous to everyone, yet also condescending, and commanded a worldwide nation and ran many successful businesses, yet distressed at the sight of a large pest. His one consistent theme was money. He wore expensive clothes, lived in an elegant castle, insisted on the best for himself and others, and quickly resorted to using money to resolve problems, as he had when offering to generously fund all of Dr. Schelderhig's research in return for catching the snake. In the palace, however, Commandus perfectly fit the role of chief boss. No sooner did they enter through a side door than he was ordering preparations for his guests, rooms to stay in, food to eat, and new clothes to wear. He also apologized to Dodd for not introducing himself properly before, and he promised to sit down with him privately that evening, after returning from other pressing business, to discuss his appreciation to Dodd for helping to retrieve the stolen triblot. His mannerisms and style were befitting of a noble leader. Many people stayed at the castle as guests, most of whom had political or business affiliations. From the back patio, a number of other smaller buildings were visible, dotting the colossal 2,000-acre estate. One building looked particularly significant. It was apparent from the double wall around it and battalion of soldiers standing near the structure that it housed something of great importance, and Dodd knew exactly what it was, the only working portal from Green to Rall. Sir Long, Juni, and Strat had preceded Dodd and his friends to the palace and had continued their journey through the gateway. This they learned from one of the waiters at lunch, who, like most people, it seemed, was dear friends with Dilly. After eating, Dilly charted an itinerary, mentioning that it was needful to take the opportunity while in Highgate to go and speak with her longtime family friend Goliam, an old and retired war hero and ambassador to Sush. She wanted more information on the 12 trouble-causing representatives from Sush who were allegedly in Green, and she knew he would be up on the most reliable gossip. Boot and Buck tried to wiggle out, hoping for a more relaxing afternoon, but were promptly denied. Dodd, on the other hand, thought the visit sounded amusing until he heard they would need to ride their horses for an hour to get to his cottage, since he was off the beaten path of the sub-routes, and another hour to return to the palace. The morning's adventures on horseback had already left Dodd sore enough to dread sitting, much less riding, unless absolutely necessary. So he claimed to be terribly fascinated with botany, and wouldn't back down from joining Sonny on her important meeting with Dr. Schelderhig. At the locked gate to the enclosed gardens, situated below the farthest west patios, Sonny and Dodd met up with the mad scientist. He wasn't exactly crazy, just mad. Apparently, from his calculations, the creature they had all seen wasn't a Dilkon Diserpentus, as Commandus had suggested. Instead, he highly suspected it was a Bloon Diserpentus. The change in type wasn't direly important to Dodd, and since Sonny knew very little from what she had read on the creatures, it didn't bother her either, until Schelderhig explained the situation. He mentioned that in the latter breed, and only in that breed, it actually took 2 creatures to produce eggs at all. They didn't lay non-fertile eggs. And to make matters worse, papas were more than twice the size of mamas. How were there 2 creatures? And how were they a different variety than the type Miz had given to Commendus? Perhaps someone else had planted them, or Miz had misnamed the breed, or possibly the good doctor was mistaken. These were all suspicious things Sonny knew Dilly would need to add to her book of everything. Inside the garden, Dr. Schelderhig became so enthralled with describing the particulars of each species of plant included in his studies that he completely changed gears and didn't mention another thing about the Diserpentis disaster. Sonny asked enough questions to fuel the fire of Schelderhig's lecturing, and the 2 of them were content reveling for hours about the strangest discoveries. Common grass would turn slightly orangish yellow instead of brownish yellow if certain fertilizers were applied before winter. And the leaves on bolus bushes were digestible to dung beetles, but not cows. And what a treat to know, the roots of bongus plants would grow twice their regular length if denied water to the point of near death and then revived properly. Somewhere in the conversation, Dodd's mind wandered away and noticed the beauty of the setting. The garden was filled with flowers and trees that looked unusual and smelled wonderful, and the foliage was planted close enough together to provide a mini jungle of sorts. A stately 12-foot stone wall surrounded the half-acre plot with only one entrance, a locked gate near Shelderhig's temporary lab and living quarters. It was a remarkably secluded place to sit and think, tucked away from the busy atmosphere of the palace and surrounding courtyards. Dodd mumbled to himself, because he was envious of the doctor's secret place, "I would love to sleep here tonight." His comment wasn't meant to trigger a response from anyone, but it did. "Then you're a bolder man than I would have thought," responded Shelderhig. "Of course, you'd be perfectly safe, as long as you walked in the dark, didn't eat any of the plants, and didn't sleep directly on these two." "What?" said Dodd, realizing he was once again part of the group. "The two plants right here. The Dolorainus and Dolupus are notorious for claiming the lives of children back in Sush, especially near more civilized cities. Parents forget to teach their young to avoid touching them for prolonged periods." Shelderhig lay down on the soft, cushioned leaves of the two species of ground cover. "I can understand why people would want to nap here," he said, making himself comfortable. When Dodd and Sonny gave horrified looks, the doctor added, "However, you're fine for an hour or so. After that, the plant releases a toxin produced when something heavy presses upon it for a while, and the poison takes effect through the skin almost instantly, causing sudden death." Sonny asked a few more questions, and Shelderhig directed her attention to the plants surrounding where he lay. They were all relatively harmless, unless digested or intentionally injected, except one. The Dilopodus demonstrus, commonly called the Night Devil by indigenous tribesmen in Sush. When Shelderhig began to discuss the evil plant, Dodd decided to move. He had been standing with the vines all around him, like an ape in the jungle. The plant looked harmless enough, half-inch thick vines and 8-inch closed pods, but it was actually capable of capturing prey. At night, when anything discharging light came near the vines, they attacked. Their main course in Sush was usually the giant glow moth and the darglow, a 1-pound bird that emitted small amounts of light to attract bugs. Dr. Shelderhig went on to note that the vines had snake-like agility when striking, and that within the pods, fang thorns released venom, which temporarily incapacitated the creature and aided the blood to flow for the plant to drink. "And so, when you sleep here tonight," concluded Shelderhig, standing up and smiling broadly at Dodd, "don't bring a light." He took a step and fell back to the ground, blaring horribly, "Ah, help!" The good doctor had ensnared his two legs in the vines and began to roll back and forth, as if he were being attacked. Dodd and Sonny jumped back in terror, and Sonny even screamed a blood-curdling cry, until they noticed Shelderhig was laughing uncontrollably. "I got you," he said playfully. Sonny gave him a deathly cold glare, then turned away while scoffing. "Boys and their pranks." Dodd chuckled and tried to act cool. "So, the plant isn't dangerous, is it?" he asked, implying with his body language that he hadn't really been scared. He had just gone along with the joke to make Sonny jump. "That depends on what you are," responded Shelderhig happily, pushing back a clump of hair that was matted to his sweaty forehead from tussling with the weed. "If you're a giant glow moth or darglow, this is a death trap. But if you're a human walking through the forest with a torch, the plant wouldn't cause you any harm, only startle you when it darts at your fire. The heat would repel the plant before it could pose a real threat." "Oh," said Dodd, nodding his head. Sonny was still looking away, truly annoyed. When Dodd noticed Sonny's upset face, he felt bad, even if he hadn't been the instigator of the prank. "Which of these plants is the most deadly?" he asked, hoping an educational conversation would revive Sonny by alluring her with intellectual treats. "It would have to be the hyssop over there," answered Shelderhig, pointing his index finger at a very plain-looking weed. It was only 2 feet tall, with small yellow leaves and a single 2-inch pod at the base. "The hyssop," said Sonny in a pouting voice. "We have those all over Green. You need to practically beat the thing to death with a stick over and over before it strikes, and even then, you'd have to be leaning right up next to it for the thorn to make a hit." "That's true," responded Shelderhig, But more adults die from trying to pull the baby weeds out of their gardens than probably all of these other plants combined, and the poison is extremely toxic. I guess they might be dangerous to a tired gardener, admitted Sonny, looking at the weed with a greater fascination. Would you like to see what I have in my lab? Schilderhig asked, directing Dot and Sonny out of the garden and toward his living quarters. He locked the iron gate behind them and entered the castle through a thick wooden door. This is it, he said proudly. This is where I make magic. Dr. Schilderhig spent the next 2 hours droning on about mixing plants to create creams and poisons and everything in between. It wasn't very exciting to Dodd, who was busy wishing his posterior hadn't forbidden him from visiting Goliam, the war hero. Sonny, on the other hand, was clearly in her element, discussing things she had read in books and trying to decipher the facts from the various scientists' speculations. At dinner, Dodd had a hard time controlling his drool. It wasn't the food. It was the souvenirs Goliam had given to Boot and Buck. Each of them had been allowed to choose a fancy-looking pocket knife before leaving, to remind them of the ongoing conflict. Dilly was pleased with the information she had received from her dear friend, so it didn't bother her that Boot and Buck walked away with better parting gifts. Goliam was an old-fashioned man of war, who didn't see any place for ladies in the effort, and therefore never offered her anything special, just an antiquated book about ladies' kitchen tales. Sonny and Dilly swapped notes while the three boys ate their dinner and listened. Boot thought the idea of a 100-foot male Diserpentis was exciting. On the other hand, Buck tried to figure out how he could convince the maids that he needed to sleep in a room on the top floor of the palace, preferably with a dozen armed guards. Dodd's ears perked up when Dilly mentioned that Goliam was confident there weren't 12 touring representatives from Sush. In Goliam's own words, it was all pig feed. He didn't believe the rumors and assumed anyone with reasoning capabilities would quickly see through them. To the best of his knowledge, there were only a small handful of people officially representing Sush as ambassadors at the time because of a rare month-long convention that had pulled the others home, and the remaining few were at Highgate, having been gathered from various towns after the poisoning. Dilly paused just long enough for Dodd to slip in a question. If the poisoning happened at Highgate, wouldn't it make more sense to have the ambassadors stay where they were? Dilly thought for a moment while flipping through her other notes. Probably not, she said confidently. After all, Highgate is the safest place, even if one breach of security occurred here. If the ambassadors stayed spread out, whoever's aiming to kill would easily find them waiting like daisies in the garden. Before the group had finished eating, the head waitress indicated to Dodd that Commendus was ready to see him. As he followed her, she first took him to a giant walk-in closet and introduced him to a chambermaid. Suits of every color and size lined the walls, and fancy shoes and boots lined the floor. "We need you to be presentable," said the waitress. "Oh, thank you. That's kind, but I was already given these clothes," responded Dodd, pointing at his stylish pants and ruffled silk shirt. "Certainly you needed something to wear when you were out. Now that you've had your supper, it's time to dress up a notch. Commendus is in his official office, so I can't have you barge in like you've just returned from a stroll through the courtyards. You need to show respect. Have Jushi help you try some of these on." The lady walked out of the room, leaving Dodd with the chambermaid. "How about this?" suggested the girl, directing Dodd's attention toward an outfit that was organized neatly on a table. It contained a charcoal-colored formal five-piece suit, complete with shoulder attachments and gold cufflinks, a dazzling white shirt that did appear to be fancier than the one he was wearing, a pair of shiny shoes with unusual tassels, a black hat that fit perfectly, and a pair of dark wool socks. "The suit-up's right there," said Jushi, pointing to a small room with no windows. The door was unusually thick, and the lock was on the outside. "Can't I change somewhere else?" asked Dodd nervously. "Like, what about over there?" Dodd indicated in the direction of a cozy corner where drawers of clothes blocked the view adequately to provide some privacy. "Don't be silly. I'm not that kind of girl." "Oh, no, 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 that's not what I meant," apologized Dodd, blushing three shades of red. "I just thought the lock on the outside of the suit-up was a little strange, that's all." "Yes," said Jushi, glancing hesitantly at Dodd. "The carpenter recently had to replace the door. We suffered a mishap with the last one. Unfortunately, when you order from afar, misconception can happen. Don't be bothered. I'll stand right here to assure your safety, even lockless. Or I suppose I could lock it if you preferred." "No, thank you. Unlocked is just fine, said Dodd apprehensively, stepping into the tiny room. He fidgeted with the door while taking off one shoe and sock. Then, using the sock as a wedge, he finished shutting the door such that the lock wouldn't meet properly, just in case. The room was uncomfortably small, even though it was plenty big enough to use for trying on clothes. Near the ceiling, a petite, smokeless candle burned brightly, making every inch of Dodd's concerned face clearly visible in the mirror on the wall. He had never felt claustrophobic before. However, given the circumstance, he had a new level of sympathy for anyone that had. It didn't take long to complete the task. Dodd finished by sliding his left foot into a shiny black shoe. He smiled at himself, noticing how good he looked in the incredible threads, and explained to his reflection that it was silly to have been worried about a chambermaid locking him in the closet. No sooner had he let his guard down than something prickled his neck until the tiny hairs stood on end. Clink, clink. The lock made a noise. Dodd froze. He wanted to throw his weight at the door, but also feared whoever was trying to lock him in. It was like confronting a thief in the night. He couldn't decide whether to face the person and attempt to escape or remain in the closet safe from immediate harm. Thoughts of running out of air rushed his mind. A few moments passed in silence, with Dodd praying it was only his imagination. And then it happened again. Clink, clink, clink. This time it was unmistakable. Someone was definitely trying to make sure Dodd couldn't get out, and whoever it was realizing Dodd's ingenuity had thwarted his plan to use the lock. "I refuse to die in a closet," muttered Dodd. With a big kick, the door exploded open, making a thunderous boom as it swung around and pounded the adjoining wall. Dodd lingered back, terrified, hunching double-fisted, and preparing to run. But to his surprise, Boot was standing in front of him, smiling. "Whoa, Zip-Odd, cool down," he said, rubbing his elbow that had been grazed.
I thought you were someone else," confessed Dodd sheepishly, flushing with embarrassment as his hands went limp.
"Well, it's a good thing Jushi left. She was hugging the door like moss on a stump, guarding you. If her dress had bumped the handle..."
Boot paused and looked down at the floor while shaking his head slowly. Then he jumped unexpectedly at Dodd with his hands flying in the air.
"Boom!" he blurted obnoxiously.
Dodd startled backward, his exhausted heart once more racing.
"Jushi would have been squeezed out permanently if I hadn't come along," said Boot proudly. "You're lethal."
"I thought someone was trying to lock me in," complained Dodd, attempting to regain his composure.
"Actually, I was," admitted Boot, nodding admiringly. "Nice trick with the sock. I'll try to remember that one."
Dodd squinted uncomfortably, leaning over and still gasping.
"You got me," he said, forcing a pathetic chuckle.
Boot shuffled one foot as though tormented by his conscience. He looked like he sincerely felt bad.
"You know me, Dodd," he confessed with a heavy sigh. "I can't seem to help it. Pranks follow my path. Not intentionally. They just slip out everywhere I go."
Boot stuck out his hand and helped Dodd to his feet. "Sorry if I got you worked up." The serious apology faded quickly as a grin crept across his lips.
"You should have seen the look on your face, though," he added, nudging Dodd with his sore elbow. "It was priceless. Who did you expect to see, anyway?"
"The Dread," said Dodd flatly.
"Here in a closet?"
"I expect him everywhere," said Dodd, feeling frustrated. "I know we'll meet soon, and this little episode in the walk-in just reminded me of how unprepared I am."
"You mean the suit-up," clarified Boot, smirking. "Don't confuse it with a regular small room in front of noblemen. They get awfully particular about the wording of their things. Besides, relax and stop worrying. I've never met the Dread. Buck's never met him. Dilly hasn't even met him. And you know Dilly. She flirts with everyone."
Dodd squirmed uncomfortably.
"I'm sure you must think I'm crazy, Boot, but I feel he's on to us, especially me."
"That's all right," assured Boot, losing his playful tone. "Just don't get so anxious that you accidentally knock a poor maid unconscious." He then stood a little taller and added confidently, "Besides, if the Dread wants to mess with you, he'll have to face us both." Boot reached into a leather bag that resembled a fanny pack and produced a shiny gold pocket knife. It had an ivory eagle inlaid in the middle. "Here," he said, carefully handing it over to Dodd. "I talked Golem into letting me choose one for you, too. I would have given it to you over the dinner table, but did you see the jealous look on Dilly's face when Buck and I showed them off? She wanted a knife, not a kitchen book. Don't tell anyone, all right?" Dodd gently turned the present over and noticed the other side of the knife. It had a horse, the exact same ivory horse Boot had held up at the table, including a tiny brown scratch on one of the rear hoofs. When Dodd commented about how wonderful the craftsmanship was, Boot excitedly gave part of the same story, explaining how it was the last knife made by an expert swordsman who had died defending liberty. Though when he realized Dodd was catching on, he added a few different, clearly fictional details, hoping to keep his act a secret. Boot knew Dodd wouldn't take the knife if he found out it was his only present from Golium. It was a special moment. Boot often played the part of a handsome troublemaker, or a privileged upper-crust brat, or an I-can-do-anything-better-than-you-can kind of jock. Yet this was a glimpse of his hidden sweet side, the good boy that wanted everyone to be happy and would give you the very shirt off his back rather than see you go cold.
"Wow," responded Dodd, suddenly feeling choked up. "I'll cherish this forever."
He looked the knife over respectfully and slid it into his front vest pocket, under his suit coat. Regardless of the noble individual who had made the knife, Dodd loved it because Boot had been generous in giving it to him.
"It'll bring you good luck," added Boot, his eyes beaming with the joy of having secretly done something nice.
"Come on, I'll show you to the formal office. You don't want to keep Commendus waiting. And here, let me first help you with that tassel. You put it on backwards." The meeting with Commendus was mostly like a stuffy, forced greeting from the CEO of a major company. Almost everything sounded canned and proper. He officially offered thanks on behalf of Highgate and issued a written invitation for Dodd to return another day, with one guest, to receive a gold medal of honor. He also suggested the names of some influential people that would be attending the banquet and then asked Dodd to come dressed in the new suit he was wearing, adding in passing that of course Tritacello, Dungo, and Bowler would all be present to receive medals too. When the formality was over, Commendus stood and pointed toward the door.
"Did you know my grandfather?" asked Dodd, feeling uncomfortable about saying anything after having received a commission to leave.
"Your grandfather? I don't think I've ever had the pleasure of meeting him. Or if I have, I don't recall it offhand. I'm busy enough that I meet a lot of people casually in my travels. You understand."
"You don't remember Pap?" asked Dodd boldly, finding his nerve.
"What? Your grandfather was Pap?" sputtered Commendus, looking surprised.
"Yes, and he still is Pap. I prefer to think of him as having gone on a long trip," said Dodd.
"The Pap?" asked Commendus, unconvinced. His eyes narrowed as he reassessed Dodd.
"The very one that was poisoned in your house," blurted Dodd quickly, sensing a chill of hostility the moment he said it.
"Though I fully understand that you couldn't have done much to prevent it. I mean, when the Dread sets his sights on something, he doesn't stop until he gets it."
"Yes, that's very true. The Dread, my goodness! I hate thinking of the Dread," said Commendus hastily, looking annoyed and flustered.
"I would rather hope that the wine they were drinking was poorly brewed."
"You mean grape juice. Pap didn't drink alcohol," said Dodd.
Awkward glances were exchanged during a moment of silence. Apparently, people didn't usually correct the great head of democracy, especially young ones with no clout.
"Yes," said Commendus coolly, searching the air for a better answer. "I suppose they could have been drinking poorly, gathered grape juice."
Commendus stumbled over his words, letting the truth sag, and was caught three times by Dodd until he finally snapped and vomited out his true feelings, selfish and calloused as they were, for he couldn't hold them back any longer with platitudes.
"It was an awful night for me, Dodd," he yelled bitterly. "You can't even imagine how bad it was. As a proper host, it was my duty to explain to everyone else that the strange occurrence was not likely to happen again. And all the while, I had to keep looking over my shoulder, protecting myself from the assailant. I mean, Dodd, it was sad that Pap died, but what would Green do without me?"
Dodd blinked at his arrogance and candor, more stunned than anything.
"Anyway," continued Commendus, purging himself of his hidden thoughts, "anyone who thinks for half a sneeze about it can see that I was the main target of that attack. Clearly! The toast to good health would have been mine if I hadn't been so troubled by the nagging of a sudden business mess that night. I was moments from death holding an empty cup when chance snatched me, called me away to solve a dilemma before the juice was poured, and here I am, by the thickness of a thread, left alive."
Dodd was wide-eyed and all ears, finally hearing the first-hand account of his grandfather's final hours, but feeling simultaneously uncomfortable that he was witnessing the meltdown of a great leader.
"My men are idiots not to see it," blared Commendus. Who could be so dumb as to suppose that Pap and those kids from Sush were the targets? What foolishness! I'm sure I was the one that the Dread really wanted dead. Just look at me! Look at this! Commendus waved his arms about, pointing at his opulent office, the likes of which Dodd had never seen before, nor could he imagine anyone else having. "And even Bomboo has turned a blind eye," exploded Commendus, raising his voice as he raged. "He's tilted his glossy eyes at the pile of droppings and missed seeing the whole team of mules pulling the cart. Nothing in Sush, and I mean nothing, could be nearly as important as me and all of the good that I do. And I ask of you, Dodd, who cares that I nearly died? No one." Commendus took a deep breath, walked over to his desk, and plopped himself down in a large leather chair. Sitting appeared to help. Bit by bit, serenity and control returned to his face as he shuffled a pile of papers, repeatedly flipping them apart and then straightening them. "I'm glad you escaped him," said Dodd, trying to offer anything that would replace the deafening lack of conversation. The silence was twice as bad since it followed the thunderstorm of words that probably shouldn't have been said. Dodd nearly slipped out of the room. Every part of him wanted to bolt, but he couldn't until things were normal. "They've all lost confidence in my ability to provide safety," said Commendus slowly and calmly, looking discouraged as he gazed at nothing. He was somewhere else in his mind. Eventually, and it did take an awkward amount of time, he revived enough to resume a conversation. "Pap was a dear friend," he said sadly, glancing at Dodd. "I'm terribly sorry about what happened. I don't know where my men went wrong, letting such a horrendous crime take place in my house." There it was, a hint of remorse, a twinge of guilt, a slight indication that he somehow felt it was unfair that he had cheated death while Pap had sipped his last breath. "Did you get a chance to speak with Pap?" asked Dodd hesitantly, pretending like he hadn't heard the past 10 minutes. For me and the rest of his family, it was almost like he faded away in his sleep. We weren't able to say goodbye or know what was on his mind. If you can remember anything he said, please share it with me. Commendus stroked his hairless chin and furrowed his brow, recalling the night. "Yes," he said gradually, nodding. "Yes, I did speak with Pap that night. He was a wonderful person to be around." Commendus smiled and turned soft. It was as though a huge balloon of frustration and anger within him had deflated. "Pap had been reading a book and said that I might find some fascination in reviewing a few passages before bed. As a matter of fact, here it is. I still have it." Commendus spun around and reached for a brown leather book that was sitting on an elegantly carved table. From the exterior, it appeared to be old and well used, though as Commendus flipped through the pages, Dodd could see they were in good condition. "Your grandfather had been studying this intently," said Commendus. "He said he found wisdom in it that he needed. Perhaps you would like to have it now. After all, Pap only loaned it to me for the evening, so I'm more than overdue in returning it to, well, let's see, a rightful owner." "Thank you," said Dodd respectfully, as he took the book. He eagerly opened it to see the title page. What book had Pap been studying right before he died? Perhaps it was a book about the Dread, or information surrounding his deeds. Or maybe it was a book about strategy to catch the Dread. No wonder he was poisoned. Or possibly it was a book about new swashbuckling moves. To Dodd's great surprise, the important book Pap had been studying while on a critical mission of great consequence had a shocking title: How to Be a Positive Influence on Your Grandsons. Dodd was speechless. After realizing how important Pap had been to Green, Rawl, and Sush, Dodd had assumed that Pap's efforts had always been dedicated to pressing concerns related to democracy and crushing evil. It had never crossed Dodd's mind that Pap could have been thinking about him and Josh and Alex. Commendus said a few more words of sympathy about Pap and apologized for blowing wild, as he put it. And as Dodd moved to leave, Commendus also asked him to keep quiet about the poisoning, especially the part about Commendus nearly being a victim. However, Dodd wasn't really paying attention anymore. Pap had been thinking of him.